The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
When you turn on the evening news, do you see what you want to see or what you need to see? Welcome to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. It seems like more often than not, the good news and people that are making it are buried into a two-minute feature piece near the end of the report. What about giving these people and this kind of news a full hour every week? Now, here's your host, Mariana Cacciatore.
Have you ever thrown your hands up in frustration because you've been misunderstood or walked away from a conversation feeling angry and fuming or tearful because you've been going around in circles trying to communicate with someone you love? Well, fret no more. I've met a woman named Sharon Strand Ellison who has a special gift of being able to dissect where things go wrong, and she's figured out how to fix it. A few weeks ago, I interviewed Carla McLaren, author of the book, The Art of Empathy. It was a great interview. And a few days later, she sent an email saying I should check out Sharon Strand Ellison's organization, Powerful Non-Defensive Communication. She thought Sharon would be great on the show. 2 hours later, I kid you not, I made myself walk away from my computer and move my body. Her website is living proof of what a generous person she is. It is chock full of free information that will help anyone learn enough to begin practicing this method right away. Powerful Non-Defensive Communication, or PNDC, is an easy-to-understand method of taking the war out of our words and learning a new way to say what we mean in a way that is much more likely to prompt people to drop their defenses, often instantly, and create the conditions for an honest, fulfilling way of talking and being understood. At Bread for the Journey, the nonprofit organization, our vision is to nurture the seed of generosity in every human heart. And the best thing I learned in my 16 years at the helm is this. The first thing we must do to nurture the seed of generosity in another person is to become a person who is generous of spirit. Then what you say and do is palpably felt by those whose lives you touch. After that, there are a billion ways you can teach generosity, but without it, you're teaching nothing. I mentioned Sharon's generosity because I walked away from my computer that day knowing that Sharon was a person who is generous of spirit, because of how much she freely gives to anyone visiting the site. Knowing that if she said yes to my request for an interview, I would share this story with our 15,000 listeners, and knowing that many of them will share it with their friends. And together we will learn what we can to take the war out of our words and do what we can to make this world a more peaceful place for all human beings. Lucky for all of us, Sharon said yes. And over the course of this week, as we were preparing for this interview, Sharon and I became friends. I'd like to introduce her to you now. Sharon Strand Ellison is a pioneer in the field of eliminating defensiveness. She's the creator of the Powerful Non-Defensive Communication PNDC process and the author of the book, Taking the War Out of Our Words. With her daughter, Amy Atkinson, she produced the audiobook, Taking Power Struggle Out of Parenting, winner of the Benjamin Franklin Award. Sharon has been a scholar in residence at St. John's University and a nominee for the Leadership in a Changing World Award. Along with doing extensive work with families, teachers, and therapists, a sampling of her clients include Hewlett-Packard, Nordstrom, Wells Fargo, Kaiser Permanente, Stanford University, the United States Department of Justice, the U.S. Navy, the American and Canadian Bar Associations, and the Smithsonian. With that, I'd like you to welcome our guest today. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing wonderfully, and thank you for that beautiful introduction, and it's true. Talking to you the other day, I knew that you were someone that had the kind of heart that I would like to be friends with also.
Thank you. Thank you. So in our first segment, we're going to be talking about the war model of communication so that you, our listeners, can understand the problems we're dealing with, and then we'll begin to talk about solutions. Sharon, you've said that defensiveness is hardwired in us. What do you mean by that?
Well, scientists have now done a lot of research on what happens when we get defensive. And first of all, any time we want to protect ourselves. I mean, if someone ignores a good idea we have in a meeting, if our children or our spouse doesn't listen to us, if someone says something hurtful to us, anything that prompts the need to protect, if we don't have a way to respond to that effectively, and start to feel the slightest bit threatened, then the neurons in the brain actually instantly change the path they go through, and they bypass the part of our brain that does complex problem solving, and they go straight to the amygdala, which really is the core defensive reactions, fight or flight. And I used to often say that when we get defensive, we think like a victim. Scientists are now saying that we think like a victim as clearly as the rabbit in front of the lion or whatever animal is chasing it or wants to eat it. Because as soon as we feel that need to protect, and it goes to the amygdala, the only choices we have are fight, flight, and surrender. And we literally can't think. And I often ask people the question, have you ever been in a room and somebody says something that impacts you? And one of the possible defensive reactions is to, you know, the deer in the headlights, to just freeze. And I'll ask people, have you thought, you know, been in a room and not been able to think of what to say or what to do? And then you leave the room, you leave the energy of that situation, and suddenly you go, well, why didn't I just ask this, or why didn't I just say that? Or maybe instead of the deer in the headlights, you spouted off and said something that you regretted later, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I said that. But whatever your defensive reaction was in the room, it becomes very clear that we can't think effectively when we get defensive. And so that is hardwired as the kind of protection. It's a protective response that probably originally was from physical threat, but we've translated it into how we communicate, so that when we feel threatened in communication, we are reacting as instantly defensively as we would if somebody came at us with a knife.
So this defensiveness sort of activates the amygdala, and we go into something like fight or flight or surrender.
Yes.
And the way we communicate is what you're calling the war model.
Yes. And, you know, there's one more piece about that with regard to it being the war model. And that is that at the root of this model is the idea, the concept of power that is at the foundation of war, which is that power struggle is how we achieve our goals, and defensiveness is how we protect ourselves. And the war model for power struggle really involves one person as the winner and one as the loser, one as the perpetrator and one as the victim. And so there's a way that we're seeing power as if it is a bar of gold that we have to fight over. So either you have it or I have it. So we have not learned about the kind of intrinsic power that we can have without being in power struggle. We've really built our communication on the idea of power struggle to achieve our goals. And perhaps one of the simplest examples of that is when you talk to somebody who's not listening to you in a meeting, at home, and it's important to you, what's the first thing we do? It's like, look, I'm just trying to talk to you. Can you just listen to me? What I'm doing right now is I'm trying to use my power to get you to listen to me.
Right.
And even in that simple example of trying to get someone to listen to us, we are already in power struggle. And that power struggle is going to prompt that internal defensive reaction in the other person, and they're going to go straight to the amygdala, and, you know, all of their common sense is going to be out the door. And even if you're telling them the greatest truth in the world, they're not going to hear it.
So before we get into how we can change this within an instant, as you have said, let's break it down a little bit and tell us a bit about this fight, flight, surrender. What are the things we're doing? And give us some examples so we can begin to identify, oh, yeah, I see myself in that.
Let's see. The three basic forms of defense are surrender, withdrawal, and counterattack. And we tend to think of surrender as the most passive. You know, you put up your arms, you give in, you allow yourself to be captured if it's in a war, or if it's in a conversation, you give in to what the other person is saying to you. And then there's withdrawal, when you don't really surrender, but you may go silent, you may leave the room, you find some way to withdraw from what the other person is saying. And then there's counterattack, when in some way you fight back. And so we tend to think of surrender as most passive, withdrawal next, and counterattack as the most aggressive. I actually believe that both in war and conversation, there are two forms, and in each of these categories. So you can surrender passively, which is the codependent type of person. In war, it's the Stockholm syndrome, where you allow the person that has captured you to dominate you, and you actually see reality through their lens. So the person in communication who does this is what we think of as that codependent person who always takes the blame. Well, I know that my husband or my wife shouted at me a lot today, but I think it was my fault because I shouldn't have brought that topic up. So you're actually taking the blame for someone else's mistreatment of you. And that's the surrender, this person who is surrendering. And I call it surrender betray, because we betray ourselves and sometimes we betray other people. Someone in a marriage who is doing this may also expect the children to understand that mommy or daddy just had a hard day today, so we should understand when they scream at us or perhaps even when they hit us.
Or people who are in sort of the growth movement, you know, or doing a lot of work on themselves might say something like, this person is in my life for me to learn something.
Yes, and I believe there's a very fine line there, because I can be learning something from someone who is behaving in a way that I don't like, as long as I learn the lesson to be able to communicate effectively and to protect myself and the other people I care about. If I'm referring to they're there for me to learn a lesson, but I'm not really learning the lesson, I'm just putting up with the treatment, then that would still be in the codependent category. So, but that's a good example where you have to be very, very careful about the distinction you're making. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the more aggressive form of surrender is what I call surrender sabotage. In my book, I actually list almost a dozen ways that we surrender and sabotage. And
give us an example.
Let's say we're going to go to the movies and our friend or our partner or whoever it is says something like, oh, well, I think that movie might be a little violent. We say, oh, I heard it had great reviews. So then they go, okay, fine, let's go. But, you know, you may see a little bit of surrender in how they say it, or you may ignore it because you really want to go to the movie. Then you get to the movie and they sit and whisper to you and they say, I knew this movie was going to be too violent. Mm-hmm. It's like, so they've agreed to something and then they really don't want to do it and they sabotage themselves
by agreeing to do it.
Yes, and we participate in that. One quick second example is, let's say we're going to go to the beach, and I want to go to the beach, and someone else in the family wants to go to the mountains, but they say, okay, fine, let's go to the beach, and they sigh. Well, we want to go to the beach, so we don't really ask them a question about it. We just go, okay, fine, let's go, and then the person wrecks the whole day. You know, by the time we get to the beach, they're going, I knew it was going to be foggy over here, and oh, man, that wind is really cold. So now we're frustrated with them, but we didn't stop in the beginning when they kind of said, okay, fine, let's go to the beach. You know, we could have stopped and said, if you go to the beach, are you going to be in a bad mood? Or do you think you could go to the beach and have fun?
Right. Both of these, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, please do. I came from a family that never finished a sentence. So.
Well, I just want to say that both of those examples, the surrender examples, whether it was surrender betray or surrender sabotage, are examples of ways in which as a family, you have to compromise in order for things to get done, because different people in a family have different, they want different things for dinner, they want to go to different places. And so I just want to make a point of saying that we're not in this show just going to be naming the problem. We're really going to get in and talk about how we can make a change so that we do compromise, and at the same time we're not falling into surrender, betray, or surrender sabotage, correct?
Yes, and even asking that question might prompt the other person to really seriously think. And they might say, you know what, I really don't want to be at the beach today. And in my process, I actually don't use the word even compromise very often, because I think if we really look at what's going on, the choices we make often will be a choice. I may really decide to go to the mountains because then you've explained to me, I was feeling a little depressed this morning and I saw that it's going to be kind of cloudy and gray there and I just don't think I can go and have any fun. Now I might stop and think and say, you know, I mean, hey, I love you, and I know you've been struggling with your depression, so that's great. Let's go to the mountains. I can have fun at the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Or when I ask that question, the other person may look at me and go, well, yeah, I really wanted to go to the mountains, but you know what? I love the sound of the waves, or, you know, I love walking on the beach. I can have fun. Let's go to the beach. And I'm not saying everything always turns out exactly the way we want it to, but I think that we can even make a decision to do something that wasn't our original choice, and if we've processed it well enough, that there's a fairly high likelihood that we can make that choice with a full heart and a full commitment.
Mm-hmm. And so we've got about 3 minutes before we go to break.
Okay,
and
so, shall I quickly go through the other two defensive modes and give a quick example?
Sure.
Or would you rather I did something else with it?
Well, I was thinking that perhaps it might be better to just say something about how we begin to change, so that he just alerted me it's 1 minute. So just maybe give me an example of a sentence or a question that you might ask and how you might ask it that could begin to change it so that we take ourselves into the next segment with a solution.
Okay. The second form of defense is withdrawal, and the passive form is withdraw to escape. But the aggressive form is a very sullen person who sits in the room in a bad mood, and you come in and you say, well, you know, what's the matter? Are you upset, honey? And the person says, I'm fine. And people often get caught into the trap and say, because they're withdrawing, but then as soon as you make a mistake and say, well, you don't look fine to me, they can blame you and say, well, I was fine till you started bugging me. But what I want to do instead is to say, when the person says, I'm fine, I might say, are you fine, or is something going on that you'd rather not talk about? Now, right there, I've actually started to change reality, because I've done it gently. I haven't countered them and told them they're wrong. And often the person may shift and say, well, yeah, I am kind of upset, or I don't want to talk about it right now, or I will. And even if they still stay in a bad mood, you've asked a question in a non-defensive way that frees you from being caught into the trap. And that's really one of the first steps in becoming non-defensive, is I want to always communicate in a way where I'm not getting pulled into being defensive or pulled into the power struggle.
Right. And you're doing it with a question, which is what I want to tell our listening audience. In this next segment, we're going to be talking about using questions effectively, which involves the wording of it and the tone of it and the inflections. And we're going to do a little bit of role playing, too, so that you can really hear about the nuance in it. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Museums are great places to work and wonderful places to visit. But are they essential? How can we improve our museum practice so that museums remain vital and essential players in society? Listen for Museum Life with host Carol Bossert, where each week we'll discuss timely and topical issues of concern to the museum community. Museum Life can be heard live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Are you a single parent trying to create the balance between home life and work life? You may be running a successful business, but how are your relationships with your family and children? If you're one of the thousands of people trying to juggle it all, tune in to Straight Up with Chris, real talk on business and parenthood, hosted by Chris Efesiou. Chris is the portrait of the success story. Coming to the U.S. with no language skills, founding and growing several businesses while raising his daughter from age 7 to adulthood as a single dad. Listen every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here today talking to Sharon Strand Ellison, creator of a program called Powerful Non-Defensive Communication and author of the book Taking the War Out of Our Words. So in this segment, we're going to be talking about ways to shift what has become a bit of a difficulty in communication. And one of the ways is asking questions effectively. Why don't you tell us what you mean?
Well, one of the things that I noticed when I began to realize that we had been using what I think of as the rules of war as the basis for conversation was I went to the dictionary and I discovered that the word question was never once defined with the word curiosity. So when I realized I'd been using the rules of war, I thought, well, how – you know, so often we think of questions as interrogating. Somebody will say, well, don't interrogate me. And people will ask questions that are entrapping, or they ask questions that have double messages hidden in the question. And so I decided to look up the word question in the dictionary. And when I found that even in the Oxford Dictionary, it was never defined as the word with the word curiosity, I thought it was amazing.
I agree.
And the word that was used over and over again was interrogation. An old definition of the word question from the Oxford English Dictionary is actually torture during a trial, like the Inquisitions. And so it made me realize that we've actually used facial expressions and a tone of voice, body language, and the way we word things in a way that simulates interrogation. And we've done it for so many centuries. And then combined with what I said earlier about how we've used the rules of war and we get defensive, we also often have the intention of trying to get through to the person, trying to get the person to change, even if our intentions are good and we're trying to help them. Honey, if you would just do your homework earlier in the evening, it would be better. Or the supervisor at work saying, you know, if you can just get here 5 minutes earlier, I'm not going to have to write you up. But even our tone is trying to encourage that person to change. And so I'll use a little example here. And if you want, we can even role play it a little bit ourselves.
Yeah, I like that.
But I often will model the tone of voice that we use for audiences when we typically ask a question. And you can't see me, but I'll first of all just ask the question even without you being able to see me, and then I'll describe what body language usually goes with it. So typically when we ask a question, we may say, and I may say to you, oh, are you feeling upset about something? And I'll ask you now, when you hear me say, oh, are you feeling upset about something? And those of you in the audience too, you can also ask yourself, what message do you hear when I ask the question that way?
Well, what I know is I want to say no right away.
So that's a defensive response. In other words, whether you're upset or not, you want to shut down. And what are some of the kinds of messages? You know, it's like, well, are you upset about something? Many times people will say instantly, you've already decided I'm upset. You're upset with me. You think I'm upset with you. And literally, people will interpret it in opposing ways. Some people will say, well, what I heard was you want me to get over it. And another person will say, oh, no, I heard that it's a demand for an answer. So when we try to add our own emotion into a question, even if that emotion is is supportive, even if I'm feeling, oh, are you upset? And I'm trying to help you. What's going to happen is the other person is going to interpret it according to their own history. So if you had a parent that when they asked a question, what's going on? Are you upset about something? That parent might mean, hey, get over it and get on with life, you know? Mm-hmm, and right. And another parent might mean, I want to know what's going on right now. You better tell me what's happening here. And so we're all interpreting it. And some people, a minority of people, will hear it as caring. And I think that happens more from those of us who came from more aggressive families. I came from an argumentative family. So if somebody said to me, oh, what's the matter? It wouldn't faze me one way or the other. I would just either say, yeah, something is, or no, nothing is, or I was just thinking. So there are people that aren't impacted by it, but the majority of people are. And so then I shift and I ask the question another way. And this time I'm going to do it again. And this time I'm going to say, are you feeling upset about something?
Oh, it's just, this is completely different. Like, I want to open up to you.
Yes. And so then this time I will ask the audience, what did you feel inside when I asked the question? So what happened to you, Mariana? What did you feel inside?
Well, I felt warm. I felt open. I felt an invitation coming from you, and a response to that invitation that was a yes. Those are not feeling words, but
well, and you've picked up on a very important point. You said that you felt warm. A lot of times, people will say that they felt safe, uh-huh. and you said that you felt warm, and that you felt like it was an invitation. And that's actually one of the words that I use to define what I call the truly curious question. It's open. It's innocent. It is inviting. It's curious. But it's an invitation. And when we put out an invitation, if it's a real one and we're not trying to coerce somebody, then the person can say yes or no. So if you were upset but you didn't feel like talking, you could feel safe saying that.
Right. And I want to make a point of saying those were the exact same words you used in both questions, right? So we're really just talking about inflection.
Yes, I'm talking about inflection, facial expressions, and also intention. And this is very, very hard. If my intention when I ask you the question is to help take care of you because I love you, then I'm going to maybe come over and say, oh, are you upset, honey? And I'm going to have this little worried, concerned frown on my face. And so there's the intention of sending any kind of message, even if I'm sending, and one of the things that's happened to people is, like, a lot of people are using what they call empathetic listening right now, which is an effort to show concern and care when they ask a question to get away from interrogation. But the fact is, I want my question to be neutral, to not be sending any message other than pure curiosity. And that makes a huge difference. And when I role play this, if we could have role played this and you could have seen my facial expression, when I asked the question the first time, I was frowning and shaking my head. And if you all just walk around the world for a while now and notice, I call it the defensive shimmy. When I role play this with people in audiences, they get shocked when they get up and role play with me and they're trying to ask the question. And all of a sudden they realize they're frowning and shaking their head while they ask the question. Like, well, are you upset about something? And then I point it out. And the next thing they do is they nod their head up and down the other direction and go, oh, are you upset about something? Or they shrug, or their eyebrows come up. So when we communicate our question, we have a whole history of so many hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years of people using questions as an interrogation that we're not even conscious of all this body language we're using, and the tone of voice, and then the intention. And that's the other piece that's important. I really have to ask my question. And, you know, I told you the story before about the little girl on the bus and also the woman that was being sexually harassed. Do you want me to use them as a model for showing
this? Perfect.
One woman who came to a conference where I did a keynote, so she really only heard about an hour of presentation about this, about the same amount all of you are hearing. And she went home, and her daughter, who was 10, said to her, Mommy, that boy on the bus just keeps doing those awful things to me. He just keeps, you know, he sits behind me every day, and he pokes my seat, and he says these things to me, and I can't get him to stop. And her mom thought, you know, I can't ride the bus to school with my daughter every day. How am I going to protect her? And so she thought she would try to teach her daughter how to ask a question the way she'd heard me teach. And so she did, and she helped her daughter think of a question. She helped her daughter with the tone of voice. And the next day, her daughter came home, and when she went, she actually kind of, her mom said, she was sort of like, well, I don't know if it's going to work, Mom, but I'll try it. So she comes home the next day, and she's kind of wide-eyed. She goes, Mom, it was really weird. I mean, I just said to him, like you said, I said, do you think I want you to talk to me that way? And he squinted at me kind of funny, and he leaned back in his seat, and then he was like, I don't know, I guess not. And he never said another word to me. Mm. Now, when I tell a story like that, if we haven't dissected the differences in intention and voice tone and body language, that story, if I asked any audience, does that story make sense to you? I mean, is that something that could commonly be done? It's almost like, well, that question is so simple. You know, why? And it's just like what you said, Mariana, that it doesn't look like there's any difference. It's the same exact question. But what if she had said, do you think I want you to talk to me that way? Now her intention is to get through to him, to get him to stop it, and her voice tone is aggressive, and she's just hooked into his power struggle, and he's going to accelerate his bullying. Does that make sense?
Right. She's not curious. She's not inviting. She's not open. She's not innocent. And her intention is to get him to do something.
That's right. And so those changes literally prompted him. And here's the amazing part of the story. I didn't hear this story until an entire year later when her mother came up to me and said, ran up to me actually in the bathroom at the hotel that we were having the conference at. I'd been invited to speak at the same conference again. And she ran up to me and told me the story. And then she said, I have to tell you that my daughter never had that boy harass her again. He never bullied her again from that one question.
Amazing.
Yes.
Amazing.
And I have had so many stories from people that literally one question altered a relationship like that. And
tell us the other story about that you told me.
Yes. So the other story is actually the thing I love about these two stories, and they both kind of came to me at a time when I hadn't used this kind of example before. So the second story was a woman who was a vice chancellor at a university, and she heard me speak, and she went home. And literally, again, it was so parallel. That night, her daughter, who was a recent college graduate and had gone to work at a corporation, said, Mom, I don't know what to do. My supervisor's been putting his arm around me. I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to make waves. Today, I was picking up a box, and, I mean, he touched me like – in a way that he should not have touched me. And I'm sad to say that people say this, but she said to her mom, I don't want to go to HR. I don't want to quit my job. What am I going to do? And her mother helped her think of a question. And this is one of the things about this is once people get the idea, it's like they can come up with very similar questions on their own without having been coached on it. And so this mother came up with the same exact type of question and talked to her daughter, and her daughter went and talked to the supervisor, and she said, do you believe I wanted you to touch me that way? And he looked at her, and he said, no. And I can see I've humiliated you, and I'll never do it again. Mm. I mean, I'm sure you know, this is unheard of.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I mean, completely unheard of. I teach this stuff, and I start hearing stories like this, and I am myself. I'm like, wait a minute, this guy could have been fired. He
right,
could have been
right,
sued.
Right, right.
He could have ruined his career, and his company could have been sued, and he could have gotten out of this without taking a level of accountability that involved admitting that he knew he had broken sexual harassment laws. And so I'm thinking in my mind, I mean, people had so often told me that this process was revolutionary and disarming, and that was that word disarming that I kept struggling with back in the early days. But I came to realize that the process could take people from being defended to sort of a place of neutrality. But what I realized with this story was that it can take people not just from defended to a neutral place, but from defended to such a place of security, like how you said you felt safe and wanted to open up. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was a positive question. Are you feeling upset about something? But even in a case where there's genuinely a perpetrator and a victim, that what happens in that case is that man felt so safe that he could actually see her humanity and take full accountability. And that's
right. I mean, it's unheard of. It's unheard of.
It is phenomenal. And if I could, can I dovetail onto one other thing that I think is a really good time to bring this point in?
Yes.
So for years, people had told me that this process was revolutionary and disarming, and I couldn't figure out back in the what I call the old days, clear back in the 70s, when the word disarming wasn't used very often, particularly with communication, what it actually meant. And I came to understand it in a sort of functional way, but I never really quite understood how it could cause someone in situations like this to shift so instantly to a completely – it's like talking to a different human being.
Right.
And I now know the answer. Dr. Joseph Ledoux and some of the people who are studying the physiology of defensiveness have really come up with some fabulous information for us. And one of the things that Ledoux says is that you can't talk someone out of being defensive. And when you get defensive, whether you withdraw, whether you surrender, whether you counterattack, however you respond, as soon as you get defensive, there's an adrenaline rush that usually lasts at least 20 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour. It could last 10 years. People stay in the same power struggle that they jump back into all the time. But just to get rid of the adrenaline takes time. And many meetings are not more than an hour. So once somebody gets defensive, even if nobody else did anything, you know, it's still going to cause this huge problem. It's going to take time for that person to even be able to think again. But what Ledoux says is if you can prompt a different emotion in the person, then the defensive response, all of that adrenaline can disappear as instantly as it came.
And so how do you prompt a different defense and a different response in someone?
Well, just what we've been doing actually does it. It's that simple.
Right.
You told me you went from not wanting to answer me to feeling safe inside and wanting to answer. And but I'm going to give you another piece of the answer to that question, which is that part of it is I'm not doing anything to prompt the defensive mechanism. My tone of voice, my intention is never to try to get through to you. So you don't have to feel any threat. Now, some people will anyway, and I'm not going to say that everyone in the world is going to instantly stop. But if I'm not trying to get through to you, if you don't feel any threat, if my tone comes down, which is a calming tone when I ask the question, and I'm not using a lot of facial expressions that unconsciously prompt the defensive response, like frowning or shaking the head, then what happens is you don't have all those cues that make you go to defense, and you can respond from your highest self.
And I can say a question like, do you believe I wanted you to touch me that way?
Yes. You beautiful. Hey, you got it. Now, just so everybody can hear it, say it the other way she might have said it.
Do you believe I wanted you to touch me that way?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the difference there in what we're hearing really reflects a difference in three things: intention, voice tone, and body language. And the fourth thing that comes into some of what we do, and I can give you some examples of phrasing and particular types of questions and ways to give people feedback. So there's also a fourth aspect that we haven't dealt with yet that we can move on to, if you like, about how the impact of our phrasing as well.
Well, we have to take a break right now, so let's do that. To our listening audience, you can see we're right into the heart of it, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
Dialogue is the single most powerful leadership tool we have to make a difference in the world. Leading Conversations with host Cheryl Esposito creates a place for that dialogue. Tune into the Voice America Business Channel every Friday as Cheryl hosts new conversations among leaders from around the world in business, government, art, economics, and social change. We'll explore big ideas and everyday actions and learn how their own leadership has led them to discover a newfound sense of possibility in the world. Leading Conversations with Cheryl Esposito, bringing big thinkers together in conversations that make a difference, right here on the Voice America Business Channel every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
What does a visual workplace mean to you? How does it contribute to operational excellence? And what steps do you take to put it powerfully in place? Listen to The Visual Workplace, Work That Makes Sense, to find out. Each week, Dr. Gwendolyn Galsworth, visual workplace expert and award-winning author, shares tools and strategies to help you make the workplace to speak at a glance without saying a word. Learn to work safer, faster, better, and at far less cost, no matter what business you're in. Tune in to The Visual Workplace every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Business.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking with Sharon Strand Ellison about her program, Powerful Non-Defensive Communication. And in the last segment, we were talking about how to formulate questions and how to communicate them, and being open and innocent and curious, and our intention and our body language. So you, at the end of that segment, you were talking about phrasing. Why don't you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, in terms of communicating the war model, we're often phrasing things in a way that is entrapping with our questions, or blaming or critical when we give feedback to people, or when we state our own thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, we're stating opinion as fact, or when we're telling people, trying to create boundaries with people, we're making demands. So we're doing it in ways that are prompting those defenses. And so I've sort of created different ways to ask questions, make statements, and make predictions or set limits. And one of the things I've done is I've outlined about 14 different ways to ask questions, and each way of asking, each format for asking questions will get at a certain kind of information. So instead of just randomly asking questions that seem to be fueled by our own agenda, I'm asking questions that go deeper into what the other person said. I'm going to give you a really quick example that can help you see how what happens is that every word a person uses is a blueprint. So one little kid might run up to you and say, "Billy hit me, but I showed him I'm strong. I hit him back." And what the adults typically do is, you know, depending on who you are and what your belief systems are, one person might say, "Hey, good, you showed him he can't push you around." And someone else might say, "Well, would you like me to show you a way to be strong without having to hit?" And so there, both cases, we're going to our own agenda. But what I want to do is I want to ask a simple question that is simply, "What do you mean by?" And you fill in the blank with a single word. And the results can be absolutely amazing. So if you say to this child, "What do you mean by strong?" you could get all sorts of responses. "Well, I meant that I showed him I could protect myself." Or, "I meant, well, I was scared, but I didn't want him to know it or he'd keep bullying me." Or it could be, "Well, I showed him I'm better than he is," or I showed him I can get him back no matter what he does to me. You know, each one of those answers has a very different concept behind it. One is self-protection. One is vindictiveness. One is hiding fear. So basically, when we run on so fast to respond to people, we're not finding out that every word, when you ask someone what they mean by a particular word, they'll take you deeper into the meaning of the taproot of the meaning of that word in that situation.
So this is really helpful when you're phrasing your question.
Yes. What do you mean by X word? And I'll tell you two very quick stories. One story I'm going to carry through with all three parts, the question, the statement, and the prediction. So you can, all three types of questions, I'm sorry. So you can really see how deeply you can go into something so simply.
Great.
And this is a story about a plumber. And he came to my house, and I noticed while he's working on my dishwasher that he had two rings that looked identical on the third finger of each hand. And so I said, "Are those rings identical?" And he said, "No, my father, one ring is my wedding ring, and the other ring belonged to my father. He died, and I'm trying to honor him." Now, in this sentence, there's more than one word you might ask about. So some people will say, "What do you mean by honor?" And that is going to take you to some good information. The question I asked, because the word trying often suggests you're trying to do something and you may not be succeeding. And so I said, what do you mean by trying? And he said, well, my father was a complicated man. Okay, so Mariana, what's our next what do you mean by question right there? What do you mean by?
Complicated man.
Now, you just did the thing that people often do. You put in two words instead of one.
Oh.
You said complicated man. That opens two doors. He could go off on who he was as a man or something, or he can tell me what complicated mean.
Right,
so,
of course.
So you've got the idea, but I wanted to just say, what do you mean by complicated? And so he said, well, my dad quit his job as an investment banker and took a job as a meter maid, but half the time he'd put money in the meters instead of giving people tickets. So, I mean, we're going to an interesting place here. Now, I'm going to leave that story in abeyance for a moment. I'll come back to it in a minute, and I will tell you one other story that shows the incredible power this can have when you say, what do you mean by? Someone who took a workshop from me in a professional setting went home, came back the next day, and said, I have to tell you all a story. The day before this training, I was talking to my brother, and he had recently had one of his best friends commit suicide, and he had said it was hard. And I kind of went off on, yes, I know, remember, I had a friend in high school that died, and it wasn't suicide, but it sure was hard. And then I kept talking to him. He's my younger brother. They were both adults. He's my younger brother, but I've always kind of talked for him. He's never been very verbal. But I went back after I learned about the what do you mean by question, and I said, when we talked yesterday, you said it was hard. What did you mean by hard? And he said, well, sis, I mean, he's on my calendar. I was supposed to have lunch with him this week. What do I do? Do I leave him there or do I erase him? And she said he talked for 45 minutes after that. I met her at a conference 9 months later, and she said, my brother's still talking. I had told my dad how much he talked that day, and he said, no, he never has talked that long. He didn't talk like that. And but she said he joined a group, a group to deal with the pain and the loss, and he'd become like a different person. So we're talking one single question about one word, and it can change a life.
Mm.
So the second form of question is to that I wanted to share with you is to ask about assumptions. And a lot of times we don't ask directly about our own assumption. So in this case, I'm going to go back to the plumber story. And I usually ask an audience, what's your assumption about why this man, the father, quit his job as an investment banker and took a job as a meter maid and gave people their money back or put money in the meters? So do you want to give me one example of your assumption? Mariana, why would you think this man would do this? What's one possible reason?
He wanted to change his relationship with people and money.
Great. He wanted to change his relationship. So people say everything from he was having a midlife crisis to he, you know, had a Robin Hood complex to he had embezzled money and he wanted to get out of
right.
the banking. I mean, there were all sorts of answers.
Right.
And so what I want to say to you is, how often do we have within ourselves we have assumptions almost always
right.
about what's going on with someone else, but we often don't ask them. And if we don't ask, we will solidify it into a truth. We'll
right.
believe it. In a sense, we're solidifying it into a prejudice because we don't even know whether it's true or not.
Right.
And the thing I want to tell you is, if you ask about an assumption and you're wrong, the other person will self-correct instantly. If you said, did he want to change his relationship with people, and that's not right, the other person's go, oh, no, that wasn't it. It was this. They will literally tell you, no, that's not right, and tell you what it was. In my case, I thought, he quit a job with some social status, took a job with less social status, and then he broke the rules of that job. So I said to him, did your father have issues with authority? And he said, yes, and how? In fact, he could be, and many people interpret his actions as very generous in giving the money back and things like that. But he said, my father could be very generous in the community, but he could also be very abusive at home.
That was the complicated part of him.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And in a minute, when I talk about questions about intention, I will I will share with you what the end of that story was. That was the end of my conversation with him at that time. But there's one more. There's one more little round with it.
Okay.
When we ask about assumptions, I had a story from a husband and wife where they had been very close when they dated, and he was a very tender, open man. But then as they'd been married longer, he tended to shut down more, and she didn't understand, and so she got angrier, and then he'd shut down, and she'd say, well, are you going to talk to me? And he'd say, I don't have anything to talk about. And she'd say, oh, right, I'm not a stupid woman. And finally, she started really working with the non-defensive process, and what she said was, are you going to refuse to talk to me no matter how much pain you're in? And she said he just sat there like stone for a while, and all of a sudden tears started running down his cheeks. And they had an incredible conversation where he realized that he had gotten more and more like his dad, who didn't talk, even though that wasn't where his own heart was. So again, it's like that single question was able to be incredibly transforming.
But let me ask you a little bit about that question. In that question, she made an assumption that he was in a lot of pain. I mean, it might be an easy assumption to make, having lived with him that long, but it was an assumption, yeah?
Yeah, you're really good. You really picked that up. And I should have qualified that. So her question actually wasn't as pure as it could have been. The first question could have been, are you in a lot of pain and not feeling able to talk about it? So, but sometimes when you get the voice tone and you're not trying to invade the person, because she'd been trying to invade him before to get information. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right, I do.
So when she said, are you going to refuse to talk to me no matter how much pain you're in, that it worked, even though she had an inherent assumption in her question that she had not addressed first. But that's a really good pickup there.
Right. So
the third, I'm going to quickly do the third form of question, and then I'm going to run you through the steps in the non-defensive statement. The third form of question I'd like to give to you is about intention. And you can ask about intention one of two ways. You can say, what was your intention in saying that to me? One time, a mediator who was working with a husband and wife, actually, instead of just She heard the wife say something that sounded pretty harsh, and she usually would have just looked at the husband and said, well, how did you feel when she said that? But that's a little leading, because she's already decided there's something wrong with what the wife said, and so she's wanting to remain neutral but pull it out of the husband to have him respond to it. Instead, she shifted and just asked the wife the intention question, and she said, what was your intention in saying that to him? And the wife said, I wanted to hurt him. And as soon as she did, she dropped into what she was feeling, and all of the entire everything that happened in the mediation just shifted intensely.
And I want to talk here a little bit, because what's come up for me now in listening to you is what the vulnerability, this shift that we have to make with this new model that moves our understanding of vulnerability as a negative to something that is a strength. Can you explain this?
Absolutely. That was a huge piece when I wrote my book, because I use the word vulnerability in my book, and even people that are close to me and know my work said, oh, but that's such a negative word. It's, you know, it's like being a victim to be vulnerable. And so I thought to myself, well, what's another word that would be the same as vulnerable? And I ultimately came up with the word open. Really, vulnerability is just openness. But in a war, you're not going to be open. You're going to be closed, because you want to defend yourself and you want to fight other people. And so the war model is built on defensiveness for self-protection and power struggle to achieve our goals. And this model is built on a willingness, A, to be much more vulnerable and open than we usually would be, and B, to be much more direct and honest than we usually would be. And there's a magic alchemy between those two that somehow seems to allow other people to see us as real and sincere, and to see our humanity. But it's
question,
a hard switch.
Yeah, that question that the mediator said, you know, what was your intention in saying that to him, prompted this woman to be both open and honest.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And that's what you were talking about when you said things can change in an instant.
Exactly, exactly. And so, like in the case of the plumber, when he told me the answer about his father, later people would say, well, what do you think his intention was? when his father had actually been quite violent at home. Why was he trying to honor him? I had a chance to talk to him later, and I asked him. And he said to me, my intention was to recognize the complexity in all of us.
Mm.
And when and that's so important to me. And so, you know, those three questions, and he even told me about how he was with his sons, and he wanted them to respect all people, but he didn't want to go overboard so they would rebel. And I mean, here's this man that walked in my door looking like kind of a tough guy, you know, and right. And yet three questions went to the heart of something that was one of the most important things in his life.
Right. Oh, just listening to you and being on your website and listening to so much, to our listening audience, there's something on our website called The Learning Room, and there are all these audios, and you can begin to really see how this works, and it's listening. You're not just reading something. So we're here at the end of our show, believe it or not, and I just want to say how much just having this hour to spend with you makes me want to really look at the way I communicate and find new ways to ask questions, to make statements, to that bring about more of that openness and honesty in me and in the people I communicate with. I want to first of all thank you very much for creating this body of work, Sharon. And I want to say to our listening audience, I'm going to have Sharon back on the show because we only covered about half of what we wanted to cover.
Yes. Well, my hope is, you know, most of the time, even when I present an initial workshop, the question asking is really the most important first piece to work with, because we so often tend to run off into a statement trying to help people or tell them what to do. So this question asking, really, if people can walk away and begin to just think about how to stop and ask a truly curious question, then I think we have the power to transform what we feel inside, to transform our own relationships, and really to create something that is a very different way of being in the world.
And that's really how, one person at a time, we're going to bring about peace.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sharon. I am just touched and honored. I'm so excited that I have a new friend.
Me too.
To our listening audience, Bread for the Journey is a nonprofit organization that could use your support. If you find a place in your heart to make a financial contribution, or if you'd like to start a chapter of Bread for the Journey in your town, please go to our website at breadforthejourney.org. If we all pitch in a little bit, we can change the world. And I close today, as I do every show, with this. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free.
We hope our program inspired you this week. Please join Mariana Cacciatore for another edition of Bread for the Journey next Saturday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.